This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this week, 2.5 million people from around the world are expected to come together for the 14th International Celebration of World Youth Day, led by Pope Francis. What makes this year's World Youth Day particularly special? It's being held in commemoration to Pope John Paul II, the father of World Youth Day, and its location is John Paul II's hometown, Krakow, Poland. John Paul II came up with this event because he believed that young people don't just need to be told what to do. They need someone to accompany them. They need someone to encourage them. In 1986, at an annual event that would lay the groundwork for World Youth Day, Pope John Paul II told 300,000 youth gathered in St. Peter's Square, "You are the Pope's hope. You are the Church's hope." From then on, every 2 to 3 years, World Youth Day had become a key part of Pope John Paul II's pontificate, meeting with millions of the world's youth in such cities as Denver, Paris, and Toronto. The 1995 event in Manila brought a gathering of a stunning 5 million people, one of the largest gatherings of people for any reason in human history. And in honor of the World Youth Day celebrations this week, for the hour, we celebrate the life of its founder, Pope John Paul II, a Polish man who was the first non-Italian pope in nearly 500 years, and the youngest, 58, in almost as long. He was the third longest reigning pope at over 26 years, the most extensive traveler of any pope in history, because it's where the people were, visiting over 129 different nations and visiting these United States 7 times. By now you may know we're talking about Pope John Paul II, born on this day in history in the year 1920. Born bearing the name Karol Wojtyła, taking the name John Paul II when he became Pope. For the hour, we'll bring you his life story and zero in on one particular story I referenced, his role in taking down the Soviet Union and restoring freedom to much of Europe. It's a story told in the extraordinary documentary 9 Days That Changed the World by Newt and Callista Gingrich and a dear friend of mine, Vince Haley, who helped. A great Catholic guy. Make sure to pick up the DVD at GingrichProductions.com. I promise. When I watched it for the first time in the Minneapolis airport, there's a scene in the middle of this movie, and I was not a Christian at the time. I was just weeping. It blew me away. And his life story will blow you away, and this story will. And so now we bring you some of the highlights, starting with Catholic theologian George Weigel, on Karol Wojtyła's childhood in the small town of Wadowice in southern Poland, growing up in a modest apartment across from the local church.
He grew up there with his widower father. His mother died before he was 9 years old. And an older brother, a doctor, died when he was 12 years old. So the family was the father, a retired military officer, and young Karol Wojtyła. He was a brilliant student. He was, by his own testimony, obsessed with the theater. He was a great sportsman, hiking, skiing, swimming. He was a remarkable young man whose many gifts and talents were somehow integrated by his faith. From very early on in his life, he was a youngster of deep Catholic piety.
Wojtyła attends college, well, until he doesn't. Newt Gingrich brings us this story.
The son of the president of Wadowice's Jewish community, Jerzy Kluger, was a close friend of Wojtyła.
We are playing soccer, and when we are starting to play, to make two teams, the easiest thing was, let's play Catholic against Jews.
In 1939, Germany invades Poland. The Nazis arrest professors and close the university in Krakow. Compulsory labor is ordered for all adults and for all Jewish males aged 14 to 60. Concentration camps are opened. To avoid arrest, Wojtyła works in a stone quarry and later at a chemical plant.
Newt continues the riveting story.
During the war, Wojtyła helps form an underground theater company called the Rhapsodic Theater.
Rhapsodic theater was aimed at keeping alive the memory of Polish culture at a time when the German occupation was determined to eradicate that culture, to kill Poland from the head down, if you will.
The idea of a rhapsodic theater is something incredible. Namely, it is an idea that you can fight with your enemy with a word, with a meaning of a word, with significance of a word.
So from that experience, I think he came to the conviction that the word of truth, spoken sharply, clearly, forcefully enough, had the ability to cut through the static of the world's lies in a singular way. And that was a conviction he would deploy to great effect later in his life.
In 1941, Wojtyla's father dies. He prays beside his dead father all night long. He later writes, quote, "At age 20, I was alone in the world, having lost all of the people I love." Here's George Weigel again on the young man's entrance into the priesthood and the role World War II played.
Karol Wojtyla's pilgrimage to the priesthood was an interesting one. As a young man, many of his friends and teachers thought that he was a natural candidate for the Catholic priesthood. He did not think that. He imagined his life unfolding as a Christian layman in the theater, perhaps later as a teacher of drama and Polish philology. I think it was the experience of the war, an experience that he once described to me as humiliation at the hands of evil, that began to intensify his reflection on what it was that God wanted him to do with his life. So in the fall of 1942, he approaches Archbishop Sapieha, the heroic leader of the Catholic Church in Krakow, and is accepted as a clandestine candidate for the priesthood.
And clandestine because the Nazis forced the church to largely go underground. An estimated 3,000 priests were killed during this time. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. After these messages, more on Pope John Paul II's life in celebration of World Youth Day, the event he founded, that this week is taking place in his hometown of Krakow, Poland, and where more than 2.5 million people are expected to attend. This is Our American Stories, and we're back with our hour-long celebration of Pope John Paul II's life in celebration of World Youth Day, the event he founded, that this week is taking place in his hometown of Krakow, Poland, and where more than 2.5 million people are expected to attend. And we're focusing in on the summer of 1979, the 9 days that changed the world. And they did. And not enough people know about these 9 days, and that's why we're bringing them to you. And Newt Gingrich and his team, Newt, a Catholic himself, Vince Haley, a good friend of mine, a Catholic, they stumbled upon this story and they just had to tell it. They had been visiting the Vatican and dug up some incredible archival footage for this remarkable story that we're really about to dig into now. The one Polish institution that came out of the war more or less intact was the Catholic Church. In 1958, Karol Wojtyła was appointed auxiliary bishop of Krakow and later appointed cardinal. The regime knew he could be dangerous, and they started doing, well, what every totalitarian government will do. They started investigating him. That same decade, the communists had built a city without a church and called it a workers' paradise. Again and again, the people erected crosses, and again, they were taken down. The city was called Nowa Huta, and it was Wojtyła who was responsible for the long, steady push to build the church there, and he just wore the communists down. There was one word that summarized his message at this time. It was love. Anything in this world, he said over and over again, could be solved through love. On October 16, 1978, Cardinal Wojtyła was elected Pope, the head of the Catholic Church, taking on the new name Pope John Paul II and a new home at the Vatican. Only a few months later, he makes this announcement that puts the Soviet regime in quite a pickle.
In January of 1979, the Pope announces he will return to his home country to commemorate the 900th anniversary of the martyrdom of St. Stanislaus, the patron saint of Poland who was murdered by order of the king in 1079.
Well, for the communist system, it was a very difficult situation because refuse coming of the Polish Pope to Poland would be a disaster on the propaganda levels.
The authorities in the Kremlin, the men in the Politburo, rang up the Polish communists and said, don't do it. Brezhnev himself got on the phone and said, you're taking too big a risk. We don't want the Pope to come. And their reply was really, well, he has to come. The Polish people just would not tolerate the Polish government not allowing a Polish pope to visit Poland. I mean, the idea of keeping out the popes whose name was Karol Wojtyla, no, it was absurd. They knew it, and they convinced the people in the Kremlin. But both sides knew that they were taking a tremendous risk.
The Soviets didn't want him to come for 2 days during the anniversary of St. Stanislaus because it was an anniversary that would invoke the brutality of totalitarianism and a citizenry that stood up to it. So the Pope said, fine, I won't do that day, but I'll come for 9 days in June instead. A pretty nifty negotiator too, this man. The new dates meant that the Pope would be there for the Feast of Pentecost, the traditional birthday of the Church, when the Holy Spirit descended upon the apostles and empowered them to preach and teach in the name of Christ. What a masterstroke. Something the Nazis and now the Soviets had long sought to oppress. Actually, I don't even think they even knew. That's the thing. This religious and now political significance of that day was not lost on the Polish people. Here's George Weigel and then Newt Gingrich on the significance of this trip.
The 9 days of John Paul II in June 1979 were 9 days on which the history of the 20th century turned in a dramatic way. One third of the country saw him live. Virtually everyone saw him or heard him on television or radio.
Within hours of his arrival, the communist leadership was deeply troubled. Pope John Paul II was challenging their regime. To Communist Party leader Edvard Gierek, the Pope calmly asserts that Poland has the right to the formation of its own culture and civilization. It was a statement tearing into the very heart of the Marxist-Leninist lie.
The Pope then visits the tomb of the unknown soldier, bending over and kissing the tomb, paying tribute to those who fought for Polish freedom. It was a powerful strike against communism. And boy, this guy, the actor in him, understood the power of metaphor. The actor in him, by the way, it's no accident that he and Reagan both understood how to communicate nonverbally, and they did, particularly through silence. So when the Pope arrives in Warsaw's Victory Square for Mass, over 67,000 communist police officers would greet him and the crowd. 20,000 of them were undercover. These guys were scared. And the crowd started chanting, spontaneously, "We want God. We want God. We want God." Later on in the Mass came his homily. Here's University of Warsaw professor Krzysztof Meissner painting the scene for us.
I was there on the Victory Square on the 2nd of June, 79, when Pope John Paul II emphasized that Christ is the ultimate reference, is the ultimate emperor. People started to sing Christus vincit, Christus regnat, Christus imperat, a well-known song which says that the Christ wins and the Christ reigns.
And when they finished, they started clapping again. And John Paul could have gone on with his text. But he was waiting there, standing with his cross, waiting until the applause would end. and the interval was that of 14 minutes. He knew how people were repressed by their fear and how they needed this emotional liberation. And that interval of 14 minutes in his speech was a liberation from the fears and giving a sense of dignity and an opening of the assertive emotions and the capacity to be responsible for ourselves, not only individually, but for our social life, for our national life, for our political life, for our religious life. All this was what was coming to the fore in this explosion of applause.
And this was the scene that brought me to tears in that Minneapolis airport hub. A woman actually came over to me to ask me if I was okay. And I rewound it and showed her. I described the scene and did it, and she cried too. She was a Christian. I was a young, about to be, on the fence to become a Christian. The Soviet regime offered to broadcast this and other parts of Pope John Paul II's visit on national television. They did so for selfish reasons, hoping the ability for people to watch from their own living rooms would minimize the crowds. It didn't work. 3 million people showed up at Victory Square for one event alone. Not only did it not keep them away, but now the elderly and homebound were able to watch what they would never have had the chance to see thanks to the regime. And yet, the state took its control of the media coverage to an absurd extreme.
There was not a single photo or panorama of how many people were there. So that was such a blatant lie, such a paranoid attitude, so that, you know, by such primitive and completely absurd means, they wanted to convey a message that, I don't know, he was alone or I don't know what.
The Polish media covered it in a bizarre way, showing little old ladies and nuns on television, but never the Pope. I mean, someone said afterwards that the Polish communist television coverage of this was like the coverage of a soccer game when you showed everything except the ball.
That's George Weigel, and he's so good. He does so much of the coverage of the Vatican on NBC News, and just one of the giants. Pope John Paul II. What a life, and what an event he founded, World Youth Day, and its surrounding week-long celebrations this week in his hometown of Krakow, Poland. More than 2.5 million people are expected to attend the celebration with the new Pope, Pope Francis. Make sure to check out his address. It's sure to be moving. This is Our American Stories, and we're back with our hour-long celebration of Pope John Paul II's life in celebration of World Youth Day, the event he founded, that this week is taking place in his hometown of Krakow, Poland, and where more than 2.5 million people are expected to attend. But with John Paul II, this story about his visit to Poland in the summer of 79 is one that most Americans don't know, and so we thought we should tell it. Because it revealed so much about the nature of the man, the character of the man. John Paul became the first pope to visit Auschwitz, the Nazi concentration camp where over 1 million Jews were murdered. He understood the symbolic power of that. And I think he just needed to touch it and bring the world to it, and he knew he would on the visit. The Soviets wanted him to be there to send the message that the fundamental problem of the 20th century was Nazism. But the Pope realized this danger of being used. So while there, he specifically mentions that there are two totalitarian systems of the 20th century. Then came Pope John Paul II's last day of the 9 days in Poland. Again, here is George Weigel.
A
day of intense emotion in which he asks them, begs them, as he put it, not to lose touch with their cultural, religious, national roots, and in which they give him the kind of farewell that can only be imagined in novels. He had touched the hearts of people in an extraordinary way. And what people commented on afterwards in terms of the effects of this was how orderly people were. I mean, all of these things could have turned into scuffles or even riots. And there was this tremendous sense of order. It's the kind of order that comes out of an intuitive feeling among people of solidarity. We're in this together. We each have a responsibility to each other to behave in a mature and serious way. So 14 months before the emergence of the Solidarity Movement, John Paul II has created the experience of solidarity during the 9 days of June 1979.
Indeed. And it's interesting, he said, don't lose touch with your cultural, religious, and national roots. This was John Paul II to the Polish people. And my goodness, I think at a time like this in America, a leader like that is so desperately needed, who can remind us of our cultural, religious, and national roots. I think too many of us don't know and feel the consequences of that in our culture, particularly. The Polish people looked at each other in the swarms of the crowd, felt their true strength in numbers, perhaps for the first time, and knew they could count on one another, whatever transpired next. Here's Catholic theologian Michael Nowak and the Polish ambassador to the Holy See, Hannah Suchocka, on the trip's aftermath.
It was the beginning of the end. Because the Poles took heart that nothing could happen to them without it being magnified by the voice of the Pope.
It was impossible to work in the normal way. It had a special importance because we didn't know exactly what would happen after the visit, but we expected that something must happen.
The revolution would be peaceful, picking up on the Pope's primary message of love. A year later, labor strikes sweep Poland. The workers' day pledge to only end them if they can have the right to form independent trade unions and the right to strike in the future, a concession unprecedented in the history of communism, a concession the Solidarity Movement and its charismatic leader, Lech Walesa, won. The Soviet leadership didn't know what to do. One thing did happen. Pope John Paul II was shot on May 13, 1981, in an assassination attempt on his life. Many believe, including the Italian government and former CIA director Jim Woolsey, that the Soviet Union orchestrated it as revenge for his support of Solidarity. 2 years later, the Pope visits his assassin in prison. They would become friends, and the man converts to Christianity. In the year 2000, the Pope requested that he be pardoned. He was, and in December of 2014, he returned to Rome and laid 24 roses on the Pope's tomb. What a story. Again, love. This was the thing. On June 2nd, 1987, President Reagan and Pope John Paul II, friends and brothers in the cause for freedom, both gave speeches in Eastern Europe. Let's hear Reagan's at the Brandenburg Gate, where he famously said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," but where he also delivered this powerful and oft-forgotten spiritual message.
They erected a secular structure, the television tower at Alexanderplatz. Virtually ever since, the authorities have been working to correct what they view as the tower's one major flaw, treating the glass sphere at the top with paints and chemicals of every kind. Yet even today, when the sun strikes that sphere that towers over all Berlin, the light makes the sign of the cross. Yes, across Europe this wall will fall, for it cannot withstand faith, it cannot withstand truth. The wall cannot withstand freedom.
The wall cannot withstand faith, it cannot withstand truth, it cannot withstand freedom. Here's Newt Gingrich introducing Pope John Paul II's speech on that same day, and George Weigel on that speech's meaning.
250 miles away, in Gdansk, Pope John Paul II honors the heroic defenders of Westerplatte, where 180 Polish soldiers held off 3,000 German forces for a week during the first battle of World War II. His homily is specifically intended for Poland's youth.
Każdy z was, młodzi przyjaciele, znajduje też w życiu jakieś swoje Westerplatte. Jakiś obowiązek, powinność, od której nie można się uchylić, nie można zdezerterować.
In dozens of sermons, addresses, impromptu remarks, he played a virtual infinity of variations on one theme. And the theme was, you are not who they say you are. Let me remind you who you are. You're a people formed by a distinctive history and culture. And if you own that again, if you make that your own again, you will have tools of resistance to this repression that the tyrants cannot meet.
You are not who they say you are. And by the way, what the Pope was saying in Polish to that audience was this: each one of you, my young friends, finds in your life your own Westerplatte, a responsibility, a duty, which you cannot avoid, from which you cannot desert. On June 4th, 1989, Solidarity candidates won major elections, and by September had formed the first non-communist-led government in the Soviet Eastern Bloc. And on November 9th of that same year, the Berlin Wall came tumbling down, long the symbol of Soviet oppression. Pope John Paul II, what a life, and what an event he founded, World Youth Day, and its surrounding week-long celebrations this week in his hometown of Krakow, Poland. More than 2.5 million people are expected to attend the celebration with the new Pope, Pope Francis. Make sure to check out his address. It's sure to be moving. This is Our American Stories, and we're back with our hour-long celebration of Pope John Paul II's life in celebration of World Youth Day, the event he founded, that this week is taking place in his hometown of Krakow, Poland, and where more than 2.5 million people are expected to attend. And the 9 days that changed the world, the summer of 1979, the first Polish Pope comes to visit Poland. And the Soviets at the time were in charge, and they didn't know what to do. And he just ran circles around them with a simple message of love, of Christ's love. And, of course, the Soviets didn't much believe in freedom of religion, let alone freedom of expression. The Pope knew better. So at long last, as we left the story off, the Berlin Wall had come tumbling down. We now know the role John Paul II had in that important event. I think many of us knew about Ronald Reagan's. Many more knew about Margaret Thatcher's. but it was really, my goodness, this moral force in the center of Europe. And again, don't expect the American media to cover this. That ain't ever going to happen. On the Pope's role, one of the founding members of the Solidarity Movement said this, quote, "They said he had power, but he did not have power. He did not have an army. He did not have arms. He did not have troops. But his power and his arms were the truth. And that is the most dangerous weapon for criminals." And this was a criminal enterprise, the Soviet Union. In 2001, Pope John Paul II was diagnosed with Parkinson's. In 2005, he was nearing his final days. Holy Week of that year comes, and for the first time of his papacy, his health prevents him from leading Palm Sunday Mass. Here's the CNN feature, The Last Days of Pope John Paul II, on what transpired from there.
He would miss most of Holy Week.
Et dimitte nobis de vita nostra.
Instead, he watched it all on Vatican TV. At a time when Christians around the world were commemorating Jesus' last hours, the Pope's absence was symbolic. Then, on Easter Sunday, the 84-year-old pontiff made his way to the window above St. Peter's Square, wanting desperately to see and speak to his flock, who wanted desperately to hear their Pope. But the words would not come out. The microphone pushed away, the Pope's frustration evident. His close friend, Archbishop Jivich, was by his side. In his book, Let Me Go to the House of the Father, Jivich writes, "After John Paul returned from the window, he said, 'It might be better that I die if I cannot complete the mission entrusted to me.'"
There was a lovely kind of poetic arc to all of this, because if you think back to October 16th, 1978.
Cardinalem Wojtyła.
When Karol Wojtyła of Krakow was elected as John Paul II, when he came out onto that central loggia of St. Peter's Square
con aiuto di Dio,
and gave the blessing and then started to improvise. And if you remember, the papal master of ceremonies actually reached for the Pope to pull him away as if to say, "Holy Father, this isn't how it's done." And Wojtyła slapped his hand away, said, "You know, from that moment, it was clear I'm going to be Pope my way." And there at the very end, you know, that Easter Sunday when the Pope was there at the window for that 12-minute period, you know, trying to speak and just being utterly unable to do so. And at two different moments, his aides actually tried to roll him away from the window when once again he slapped their hands away as if to say, "Here at the very end, I'm still doing this my way." You know, I think there was something marvelously appropriate about that.
You bet. And after such a painful experience, Pope John Paul II carries on, and you will not believe what he does next.
3 days after Easter, the Pope tried to speak to the masses once more.
"We even tested it beforehand."
Archbishop Jivich remembers the Pope's rehearsal and his frustration after his second failed attempt.
Microfono non serviva, no?
I wouldn't have given him the microphone if I didn't think he could speak. But maybe it was the emotion of the moment, or God just wanted it that way. When he gave the sign of the cross, it was very moving. And then, nothing.
This would be the last time the world would see John Paul.
Through his inevitable suffering, through his last moments here. But he was teaching something very important. This Pope, who had teach many people around the world how to live, was also teaching in those moments how a person can die.
Indeed. And if you remember, when he just didn't speak and he allowed that audience to just clap and to chant, "We want God," And now he was letting them see him in this frail condition. That's humility. That's a total lack of pride. That's everything a good Christian should evoke. And he did it just naturally. And of course, the authorities in the Catholic Church or the minions wanted to control him. Impossible. The Soviets couldn't. And the bureaucrats inside the Vatican probably often shook their heads. Here's George Weigel on what happened after Pope John Paul II's death.
In the week after John Paul II died, 3 million people came to Rome, effectively doubling the city's population. Many of them were young people. Many of those young people knew that they were not going to get within a half a mile of the funeral service itself, and yet they felt they had to be there. They had to say goodbye in person. They had to pay their respects to a man who had summoned them to lead lives of moral heroism.
And on April 2nd, 1984, on April 2nd, 2005, John Paul II dies. And there are a couple of stories we wanted to cover with you, one by ABC News' Bill Blakemore, and another by journalist Neil Asherson. This is Blakemore's account. On the Pope's second trip to Poland, martial law had taken over. The communists had found an excuse to go in and take over the military with military force. A lot of people in America thought he was betraying his own cause. He's going to acknowledge this military regime. So he goes back on the second trip. The world is wondering, what is he going to do? Is he going to acknowledge this regime? And so we're all looking very closely when the Prime Minister and the Pope come out for their first public formal meeting. They're both standing not too far from each other in a room behind their separate microphones. And the camera pans down and we realize that the Prime Minister is standing there. I believe he had his dark shades on and his knees are trembling. And we all search for explanations. Why are his knees trembling in front of the Pope? We look for explanations such as, well, there's a medical condition or he's on some kind of medication. Ultimately, he explained, no, it was really what it looked like. Quote, I was trembling in awe at the responsibility and importance of this man in front of me. The Prime Minister ultimately said those were the classic trembling knees in front of something I knew was extremely powerful. The Pope had this kind of authenticity of nationhood, if you will, of importance, so that even the Prime Minister himself was put on notice that he was in front of the Master. It was a remarkable image that we could barely believe ourselves of the centered, calm power of this man who had come back in, gotten back on the horse. He'd been assassinated, virtually successfully, but had recovered, and now he'd come back in to continue the fight. And here's Atchison. Quote, I was standing next to him during one of his trips to Poland, and he was moving along the fence, and there was one little girl about 6 years old. A young mother sort of holding her up, and the Pope stopped, and, well, he looked straight in the eye. And he said, where is Poland? The little girl was completely baffled by the question. She sort of looked at him, giggled slightly, and then put out his finger, and he touched her. And he said, Poland is here. I mean, if you think about it, what was being said then? Not a lot. I'm moved whenever I remember it, though. In a way, you know, it bears on this question of human rights and individuality as well. I mean, it's not just a patriotic sort of statement. It's saying that while human beings survive, speaking the language or being us, you know, the nation survives. It's real. But it was also saying that what matters about the world and about human arrangements is what you carry inside yourself. That's journalist Neil Asherson. This is Lee Habib. The 9 days that changed the world, that was our focus. The life of John Paul II. What a life, and what an event he founded, World Youth Day, and its surrounding week-long celebrations this week in his hometown of Krakow, Poland. More than 2.5 million people are expected to attend the celebration with the new Pope, Pope Francis. Make sure to check out his address. It's sure to be moving. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and now it's time for our Bring Small Businesses Back series, brought to us by the Job Creators Network. And today we're talking to an entrepreneur, a job creator, Stephen Bianco, owner of College Hunks Hauling Junk and Moving franchises in New Jersey, Tennessee, Ohio, and Florida. Steve, we've had a lot of successful job creators on our show, and I've got to tell you, most of them did not go in with a textbook education. They didn't go straight down the line out of college and do what they studied. It was sort of a serendipity in large measure, Steve, and just the desire to be their own boss. Tell us about your story and how you became an entrepreneur. What was your first taste of entrepreneurship?
Well, thank you, Lee. Thanks for having me on the show today, first and foremost. Hello, everybody. You know, my first instinct, I happen to have the blessing of seeing a father who was an immigrant from Germany become an entrepreneur, pharmacist by trade, who opened up pharmacies and struggled to do that in the state of New Jersey for years. And I saw it firsthand and got the original bug. But my first real-life taste was when I was in college, and the nutrition industry had just begun. And I saw people, you know, trying to find ways to find better ways to provide for their bodies or make their bodies healthier. And on my college campus, I was at Villanova University, and I actually threw my roommate out of the room, and I opened up a nutrition store in my room underneath my bed. And I put out signs before the internet age. I put out signs across campus and started attracting students to come to my room and buy supplementation, vitamins, things that they weren't provided at the vitamin store at that particular time. And that was my first feeling of being able to provide something that people did not have. And that became very exciting to me, that they were saying, hey, this helped me. Or, I never knew about this before. Or, I can't believe I can get this from you. Thank you very much. That was my first feeling. I knew why my father had fought so hard to start his own business, because he was providing a great service for people, and that's what excited him, is that in the pharmacy world, he was able to provide a pharmaceutical store that people were able to walk in and ask him, can you please help me? My daughter's sick. I need your guidance. That's what drove him. And when people started coming in my room in college and saying, thank you, this has helped me, that was the bug.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think counterintuitively, Stephen, that people think that people enter the entrepreneurship pathway because they want the money. But I think it's so much more profound. And in fact, you look at the pay scales, and when people go into their own business, they actually sacrifice a lot. And they end up not making as much money, and very often not even out over a lifetime. It's so many other intangibles. And you just mentioned one of them. Tell me about your childhood, your preparation. Was there anything in school that led you to believe you'd be doing this other than this experience, courses you took? And where did you grow up and under sort of what economic circumstances too as well, Stephen?
You know, it's interesting. I had one of the most interesting upbringings. And I have a book coming out called Declaring America's Religion. And it talks a lot about my upbringing and the gratefulness of the blessing of my upbringing. And I came from, first and foremost, my father came from Germany. My mother was a poor woman from Georgia. You know, they met in some of the most interesting circumstances back in the 70s, a interracial couple in the 70s, before Love vs. Virginia, and formed an amazing bond that's gone over 40 years to this day. That, fore and foremost, shaped the lives of my sister and I, of being people who, number one, accept people for who they are, fore and foremost. And that was the most critical thing as a young person that my parents were able to teach us, as being open and diverse and seeing people for truly who they are. Going through that, when I went to high school, I actually, you know, my parents worked very hard and struggled to put me into a wonderful high school in the state of New Jersey. And I was able to go to an all-boys school that was a very prominent type of school. And some amazing people, presidential candidate Chris Christie's children go there. And it's one of those amazing places for boys to go to school. But that was actually my wake-up call for what I didn't want to do. I did not want to do the job that was just going down the line because this is what you're supposed to do coming out of this school. You're supposed to go to Wall Street and make millions of dollars.
Yep.
That was the thought, and that's where a lot of my great classmates went, and God bless them. But it was my view at that point in time that I literally turned and ran the opposite direction because I just wanted this. I want to create a legacy. And I started a legacy while I was in school, and we actually retired my football jersey, not because of my athletic heretics, but because we started a trend, a legacy of brotherhood and bonding and growth, where we as a team brought everybody together and said, we're going to become state champions. And this is the number that's going to represent us, making a pack and making all of us better. And when all of us rise up together, we are going to win a state championship. And we did exactly that. Went undefeated, still to this day, the only undefeated team in our school's history in football, and we won a state championship. And it was because we lifted everybody up as a community. And that was that taste of, wait a minute, if I can get everybody on the bus, to use a Stephen Covey comment, if I can get everybody on the bus, wow. That is something that I can be proud of, and that's the direction I want to go. And I can do that by having my own business, starting a company, organizing a company, and doing something that I feel is right and collectively feel as a group that we believe in. And let's make that happen.
And you heard it there. Make things happen. That's what so many entrepreneurs try to do. And when we come back, we're going to hear from Stephen directly and from so many of our small business owners across this country about the impediments to them hiring more people, expanding and growing their businesses, which is what almost every small business owner I know wants to do. And we'll learn about the impediments they face and the obstacles they face after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and it's our Bring Small Businesses Back series that we're doing each week in conjunction with our partner and sponsor, Job Creators Network. And we've been talking to Stephen Bianco, owner of College Hunks Hauling Junk and Moving Franchises in New Jersey, Tennessee, Ohio, and Florida. And you know, Stephen, so many people start off, well, with a little help. Some have some family that have money. And then there are lots of people who start with absolutely nothing. But my goodness, there's a lot of folks in between. Tell us your story and how you started as an entrepreneur.
I don't have the story of coming from nothing and building up from nothing. I don't have that story.
Right.
My father did that. He did that. He has that story. And he worked extremely hard. My mother worked extremely hard to provide that for my sister and I to then step on, but then realize, don't step over.
Yep.
Don't step over this. Step on this to continue doing what's right for the growth of other people.
You know, by the way, Stephen, people do not associate entrepreneurs and capitalists talking like this. But in the end, this is actually the engine, and these are the type of people who actually do go their own way. And I think that in large measure, Stephen, probably the seminal event of your life was actually what you said, an interracial couple in the 70s in New Jersey. I grew up in New Jersey. People always think of the South as segregated. I live in the South now. It's the North that's very segregated and still is. And so what was your experience, and how do you think that experience in your life formulated so much of your character today, even as an entrepreneur?
Lee, thank you. Thank you for asking that question, because my answer, I think, is going to be completely opposite what people would think. I grew up in Northwest New Jersey, and at that time, during the late 70s, early 80s, that was where nobody was. So I grew up, as I say, because this is part of my culture of who I am, I grew up in redneck culture at that time.
Yep.
That's how I grew up. And guess what? I had not a single issue. And this is why. Because it wasn't about my difference or being the same. It was about, this is who I am. I am a boy from Sussex, Warren County, the western mountain area, farm area of New Jersey.
Yep.
This is who I am. This is my culture. And I did exactly the same things that everybody else did. I was just a kid in that culture. At that particular time, it was Metallica, Quiet Riot, Queensryche, Led Zeppelin, Twisted Sister. And I walked around in jeans with white Reebok sneakers with the tongue hanging out and a black concert t-shirt. And I tried my hardest to grow a rat tail at the back of my head, but because my hair is a little bit different and curly, it didn't really work out for me.
Yeah,
but I tried.
Thank goodness.
And my mother made me cut it as well. But that's how I grew up. And that experience in that of coming from a household, and this is where the parental piece came in, that it wasn't like, no, Stephen, you are white. Or no, Stephen, you are black. It's no, Stephen, you are American. And you are a Sussex County boy. That's it.
Yep.
And that provided, and then they showed us, my sister and I, multiple cultures, not just a black culture or not just a white culture or a German culture. And a lot of that, I owe that to my father. The one thing my father did that I'm so proud of to this day, here's someone that moved here from Germany. That man eliminated his German accent as quickly as he possibly could because he wanted to be American.
Yep.
And that's who he was. And from that point on, like that's what we believed in. We were just American children. And we grew up in a country sort of setting. And to this day I had a multitude of relationships and friends from all different types of backgrounds. And my parents provided that to us, and that's sort of the biggest gift, and the biggest misperception that a lot of people feel, because we angle ourselves or we assume that we have to associate with a certain geographical or demographic. We assume that we have to be that particular way. No, yep. you're who you are, but where you grow up in. I don't care what religion, what color, what race you are, what economic background. It's where that culture, and we have many different styles of culture in our country. We all should be believing in the same American religion, as I like to call it. We all should have that, but we have all different sects of it based upon our culture.
Yep.
And if I'm from Northwest New Jersey, I'm a heck of a lot different in culture than if I'm from Bergen County across the Hudson River from New York City.
That's right.
A totally different cultural approach. I still believe in strong American values, but you know what? I wear a jeans t-shirt and a cowboy boots.
That's right. You know, it's interesting. I grew up in Bergen County, and Warren County was the sticks. And that's where country music was playing. And we always used to say Sullivan County, New York, or Warren County, New Jersey, might as well be Georgia, except with different accents, because it was. And people have this misperception about this great country as if there aren't rural areas everywhere, suburban areas everywhere. And those suburban areas, no matter where they are, have more in common together than the rural areas. But one thing they used to always have in common, Stephen, all of this tapestry of America, is I'm half Lebanese, I'm half Italian. My parents refused to let me speak Italian or Arabic in the household. We were Americans, period. We couldn't talk about, we'd have maybe one day where we would celebrate, one day a year we'd celebrate our Italian heritage. We didn't ignore it. But let me tell you, America, America, America. It was always the American creed, Stephen. And part of that has to do with, you know, hard work, personal responsibility. And I think this leads straight into entrepreneurship. And the other thing is building that team that you talked about. So let's talk about that first real professional experience. You're out of college. You're pursuing a bunch of different kinds of careers. Talk about the different paths you took, Stephen, because I actually believe as Americans are listening to this, they're going to get a better understanding. And we do this every week. We talk to various entrepreneurs from every walk of life, and all the stories are different. But the end game is the same, and it's that desire to start something for yourself. But talk about that road you took, Stephen.
Well, I came out of school, and after my collegiate time, I went to the United States Air Force Academy, and then I went to Villanova University, two great, wonderful institutions. And I became a state trooper in the state of New Jersey, and that was my kickoff of... Number first and foremost, it was, I want to help. And it's funny, people always say, well, you know, why did you become a state trooper? No, I really did want to help people. Like, I really did. Like, yeah. I couldn't stand writing tickets. It was the worst thing I could possibly imagine, and I fought it. And I fought it verbally as a young rookie. I fought it. I couldn't stand it. Now, someone was really doing something wrong to protect the public, sure, you go out there and do what you're supposed to do. But I couldn't stand going out there and just saying, I have to write tickets. I really wanted to provide and rush to an accident and help somebody.
Right.
And I learned so much being a state trooper. Now, during that time, that was my first opportunity to have some good strong income, and I sacrificed and saved my money. I put away everything I had. I lived at home when everyone else said, oh, you should move out. You've got a good job as a state trooper. I said, no, I'm going to stay home, and it is what it is. It hurt my dating life a little bit,
yep.
But it was what it was. But I looked at it, I said, you know what? I want to put some money away. I'm making a good income here as a state trooper. Let me still live in my old room, and let me pack some money away. And that's exactly what I did. I packed some money away, and within a year and a half, I started going out there, and I started using some of the athletic talent that I had previously, you know, had and knew about. And I was going to the tracks, and I was working out, and I was running around the tracks, and I would see a father and a daughter or a mother and a son out there on the track running and trying to make themselves better for sports. And I'd walk up to them and say, hey, by the way, if you move your arms a little bit here, move your arms a little bit there, you know, it can help make you faster. And I'd get some good responses, and people would say, hey, can you help me do this? And by the time you knew it, I had a couple people that I was going to the track and meeting up unofficially and just letting them work out with me. And I said, wait a minute here. All these people are asking me at this little local track in New Jersey, when I lived in New Jersey at the time, they're all asking me, this is a small rural area. What if there must be a lot of kids who need this help? And I saw an opportunity.
And let's hold it right there, Stephen. Hold that thought. He saw an opportunity. I would submit you would ask almost every entrepreneur or job creator, and that's what they tell you. One day they saw an opportunity. They saw something in the market, some problem that needed to be solved. When we come back, more with Stephen Bianco as a part of our Bring Small Businesses Back series, brought to us, as always, by the Job Creators Network. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Habib with Our American Stories, and now we continue our conversation with Stephen Bianco. And when we left off, he had seen an opportunity and he had taken some action. And let's rejoin our conversation.
Then I went back to my high school and I just started training athletes at my high school, and the high school let me use their tennis courts. Kept saving my money as a state trooper. And finally, I remembered my time at the Air Force Academy. They had one of the most beautiful athletic facilities for training. And I said, what if I'm able to mirror that and turn it into a smaller version of what the Air Force Academy had? An AstroTurf infield. It had weights set up on one side. It had free weights on one side. It had machines on the other side. And if you know the training world, it was very well organized to have a level of a periodization of training. With micro sections and of training protocol, and it was a great way to cross train. It was cross-fitting before CrossFit was a twinkle in somebody's eye. So I set out to say, if I shrink that down, I can provide for these young kids. And you know what? I think more kids will have opportunities to perform better while they're young in high school. And you know what? And maybe a kid can get into a school that they may not have gotten into because they've increased their athletic ability a little bit. So I opened up a 5,000 square foot facility in New Jersey. I had saved, you know, like $25,000-$30,000, and I opened up the small facility. I laid down AstroTurf. I bought free weights on sale from health clubs that were closing down, and I started advertising. I was advertising myself. I had some T-shirts made up. Put some T-shirts on some young athletes,
yep.
And people start asking. And where it really took off, and it goes back to the original question, where it really took off was the fact that we built a team, and not a team of employees. We built a team of the customers, and it became something that these young individuals were proud of. They wore their T-shirts with pride. And they were improving, not just in sport, but they were improving in life. The parents' comments would come back and say, you know, I really don't care about how he performs on the soccer field, but I tell you what, our son is now listening to us. Mm-hmm. He's actually coming home and doing his homework.
Yep.
How is this all happening? And I just said, he's motivated. He's motivated to be great, and it has nothing to do with me, and I'm sorry, Mom and Dad, it actually, you worked on it, but it has to do with the environment he is now in. He's in an environment where success breeds success, and he's seeing his peers working hard, and now he wants to do the same.
Yep.
We've instilled it in him, and you've built the foundation, but now he has seen the light. And he wants it for himself. And that's the community we started to build in the company. And it started growing and growing and growing. Not from advertising, not from what I was actually being ridiculed on my style of training. Because the academic pundits thought it was crazy. And it had no substance to it. And I kept turning and saying, it's not about the athletic training substance. It doesn't matter if a 12-year-old boy follows a certain protocol. It's not about that. That's not why he's getting better. He's getting better because he's confident in himself. He believes in himself. We're building his self-esteem. That's what this company is about. Not the X's and O's about how to have a training protocol.
Yep.
This kid is improving because we provided something great in their life, and that was that aha business moment where, wait a minute, if I can provide an opportunity for people to thrive, that's a business that's needed, and that's going to have longevity. That's going to have legs. That's going to build a legacy. And that was that first experience.
That's great. You know, Vernon Hill, who built Commerce Bank into a multi-billion dollar enterprise, started his first bank with his wife, and they had an edict on the team, and it's, let's create fans, not customers. And everything they did from then on was about empowering employees to create a servant-based culture so that the folks would be fans. The next thing you know, this bank was actually open. Steven, imagine this, when customers were free. So at 7 in the morning, the bank was open. At 5, the bank was open. They allowed dogs in because people were tying their dogs outside. They said, well, let's bring the dogs in. Change, they not only let people bring the change in, you know those big machines that take a 10% vigorish at the supermarket? He put them in for free. The kids could count their change for free, and they could make a deposit. And by the way, those kids ended up becoming lifelong customers, and they also did seminars on how to create wealth, starting with investing at like the age of 8. And the next thing you know, he has this gigantic bank. So talk about now the step up from this, from what you are now, this 42 holdings, from where you were then. What was the next step from gym owner and, let's just say, personal self-esteem guru? Because I think that that's what you were doing through physical fitness. I think you were using physical fitness as a proxy for something else. And that's, I think, what the Marine Corps does. I think that's what Paris Island is really all about. It's not about getting the guys fit. It's about shaping their character, putting expectations really high and letting everybody know, hey, we're in this together and we can do a lot more than you think. We are better than we think. Not many people tell that to people these days, but I think actually the best entrepreneurs do. Talk about what led you from this early initial experience to what you have today, Stephen.
Well, you said it right, and that's what entrepreneurs have to do. That's what business owners have to do. That is your duty. Your duty as a business owner, as a business leader, is exactly that. Be a leader. And you're looking out for the lives of the people that are placed around you. The people are placed around you for a particular reason. When you really start dialing in and thinking about that, it's become so obvious as to what the point of me doing this is. From the fitness world, I knew I needed to make a change. There was a change in the, this was a business decision, there was a change in the fitness industry itself. Everything had grown in a different direction. CrossFit was coming around, different health clubs. The athletic model was changing drastically. There was ones popping up in every corner, and it was time for me to take that into a different direction. I was also had started a family, and my children were very young, and the hours had to be changed, and I needed to make a move there. And I wanted to keep going in the business of growing people. And I found an opportunity in the franchise world, and I've always believed in the franchise world as being such a powerful tool in our American society because it allows people just like me to take something they believe in, and that's growing people, and that's my strongest belief, is finding the diamond in the rough and giving an opportunity for them to reach their God-given potential. I believe in the franchising world provides that for that entrepreneur. The entrepreneur doesn't have to be the MBA from Stanford.
Yep.
That's not an entrepreneur. That's a business analyst, and they're needed. And we
right.
need them desperately. But that's not the definition of what's needed in an entrepreneur or a business leader. So the American franchise industry has provided the opportunity for people who believe in their community, in a particular sector of a market, in a particular business model, and in people to open up a business of their own and provide that opportunity. And I found that in a company called College Hunks Hauling Junk. And although the name was cute and funky and it had some great upstart media attention, I saw it as something different.
We're going to hold that thought, Stephen, and when we come back on the backside, more from our Bring Small Businesses Back series and from Stephen Bienko. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and now we rejoin our conversation with entrepreneur and job creator Stephen Bienko.
I said, here's an opportunity, and this company, College Hunks Hauling Junk. And I said, this is a way that I can help provide opportunities for college individuals who have graduated or ones who may not even have gone the college route and open some doors that have never been opened for them and shock the living daylights out of customers. to provide something for them that they assumed they were not getting. They were assuming they were going to get a couple of guys come work on their house and take out garbage, and their stereotypical individual who was hauling garbage, or the stereotypical mover. Well, I want to shock the daylights out of you. I want to provide an opportunity for a young person who's driven, who wants something great, and I'm going to provide the opportunity and the tools, the vision, and the back-and-forth communication so that you can reach that potential that you want to reach. And let's go shock your family, let's shock your neighbors, and let's make yourself proud of who you are. And I saw that opportunity and that age demographic in this company, in this franchise. And it has enabled me to follow that belief of, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, it is your duty to provide and continue the educational life growth of the people within your company. Open them up to communication. Tell them what's happening in the world. You know, we do a Job Creators Network E2E program that we've instituted in our roll call, which we have here at our offices, where we sit down and we educate our employees about life, about American history, about government, about taxation, about wealth management. We provide, and with the help of an E2E program, which is employer to employee, we provide this information and knowledge to them so they can make better decisions in their life and better decisions for their family. And we become, as a business, an educational hub for them. Because if they're more educated in themselves, they feel better about themselves, they're going to provide a better service for the customer, and guess what? Capitalism 101, that equals more revenue, more growth. Yeah,
and more profit. In the end, more profit. And in the end, we are in the business of making a profit. And this gets me down to now some important points. And we're talking to Stephen Bianco, an entrepreneur in the franchise business, in the moving space. And franchising is, well, it's 20% of our economy. 20% of all businesses you know out there are franchises, and you may not know it. And it's everything from the hotel industry. Large part of that is franchising, straight down to fast food restaurants. Most people know about that, but not Snap-on Tools and not so many the Merry Maids of this world. Most folks don't know that this is 20% of the American economy. And Stephen, of late, a small government organization that no one knows about or really has ever heard of, the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, decided in a sort of fiat, in a move, an unprecedented move, to start to go after the nature of the relationship between the franchisor, that would be, let's say, McDonald's corporate, and the franchisees, and those are all the guys who own the individual restaurants around this country. And they're trying to now say, the National Labor Relations Board, that all of the people who work for that franchisee, all of those employees, are now employees of the corporate parent, too. And by the way, I think the reason the NLRB is doing that is because it wants to figure out a way to unionize all of these workers. But it's ignoring the contracts that guys like you and tens of thousands of franchisees have with their franchisor. Talk about the threat this is to your business. And by the way, Congress didn't pass this. This is just some agency making up a law that it impacts. And by the way, it doesn't matter what religion these franchisees are. It doesn't matter what political party they're from. The franchisees in this country have lost their minds over this. Talk about it, Stephen, and how it affects your life and, your more importantly, I think, in the end, your employees' life.
Well, first and foremost, the NLRB is an organization that is sort of flies under the radar of unelected bureaucrats that are placed in there in order for them to make decisions that they think are right. Our franchise industry has over 830,000 franchise businesses in our country. And the NLRB decided that, you know what, we're going to create a joint employer relationship between the franchisee and the franchisor. Let's completely eliminate 20 to 30% of our small businesses as we know it. And we're going to now place the risk of an independently owned franchise business, which is what you mentioned, Lee. People don't think about this, and I'll come back. People don't think about the McDonald's as an individually owned entity. That McDonald's is owned by somebody in your community a lot of times.
Yep.
That's somebody's mother, that's somebody's father, that's somebody's grandparent, that's somebody's family business. We look at it as corporate McDonald's, but that one that you go to, even though it's a monstrosity of an organization worldwide, that one that you go to is somebody's small business, and those are somebody's employees that work with them. And the NLRB wants to make it where that large corporation is now responsible for anything that goes on at the local level. Their angle on that, like you said, the one area that they're missing when it comes to unionization is the unionization of the restaurant industry. And on all the thousands and thousands of individuals who work within the restaurant industry. And they want to unionize them in order to take dues and make their political stances and pay their political dues. Not caring about the effect of what it does to an American business. You take mine, for instance. I'm a franchisee. If the franchisor becomes responsible or is at risk for things that we do in our country or has to assume that in our company and has to assume that risk, then they are, number one, going to increase prices of royalties in order to provide legal support for themselves. They're also not going to accept the applications of smaller individuals who was their first time at opening a business for themselves in their community.
Yep.
Because the risk is too high. Because now they have to worry about every single little thing that small business does and assume that risk. Well, if you're the franchisor, then you're not going to take on that risk and it's going to turn into conglomerate ownership. You are going to have a large conglomerate in order to own or be accepted into a franchise family. It will completely eliminate the franchising model as we know it. And the biggest issue with that is that franchising is the first way into private business ownership for the majority of female and minority-owned businesses. That is the entry point into the private small business realm.
Yeah, and that is, Stephen, because let's face it, when you go into partnership with a franchisor, the franchisor is providing the branding, the marketing, the delivery, and then your job is to execute on the vision, to sell and employ people and meet payroll and motivate the employees. Why would a corporate parent want to be exposed to the trial lawyers and the unions to the decisions of all these owners? They would just go, forget it. A corporate might as well buy all these small businesses because it's not worth the exposure, just as you had said earlier. Stephen, I really appreciate you bringing this to light. The Job Creators Network, you're a member of and part of, and they are proud sponsors and partners of this show. And thank you so much for just giving us the time and giving the folks out there a bird's eye view of all those people in the town that you know who own small businesses, who own a franchise. And by the way, drive down that block. I'm guaranteeing you 25% of those businesses are franchise businesses. But for all the small business owners out there and for you speaking on their behalf, Stephen, I deeply appreciate you spending the time with us.
Lee, I appreciate you for giving me this time. If anybody's out there and you believe in this, go to defendmainstreet.com and learn more about our campaign as small business owners to bring small businesses back to America. It is what built us. It's what our founding fathers built the beginnings when coming from England, built this country on all of us providing for each other in a local arena. And there are so many ways out there currently that organizations are stripping that from us, but then still crying that we need to employ people. Well, we employ people through small businesses. That's how we all get our start, and that's how the majority of us feed our families, is through small businesses. But not to mention, those are the businesses you're walking down Main Street with your family, with your children, walking into the restaurant, enjoying a Friday evening together. You are going to a small business. This is a fight we have to fight. The overtaxation, the overregulation is destroying that American dream. That's what the American dream is.
Well, Stephen,
that's what our country's been built on. We have to fight this.
We couldn't agree more, and we'll be spending a lot more time on the Bring Small Businesses Back tour, which will be going around the country in the fall, and we'll be following it. We covered the Orlando event, and defendmainstreet.com is the website, and small business is what we're here to defend always. And, Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lee.
You bet.
God bless.
That was Stephen Bianco, and he's a part of the Job Creators Network. And to learn more about small businesses, to join this fight for the freedom of small businesses, go to defendmainstreet.com. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories.